Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And the show today is a very special one. It's one I've been waiting to do for quite some time. You know, back, I don't know, it was years ago that Mark Maxwell, a good friend out here at the station, and somebody whose taste and understanding of music, all kinds of music, is just, it never ceases to amaze me. And at one point he just pulled me over, grabbed me by the neck, and held me in a headlock and said, "Listen, man, you got to listen to this cat." And he introduced me to Matthew Shipp, to Matthew Shipp's music. And since then, I've gone actually a little crazy. I was telling my wife this morning that trying to even pick music to play today, because that's what we're going to talk about. That's who we're going to be talking with. We're going to spend the hour talking with jazz musician Matthew Shipp. And we're going to be talking about his work, his views, his place in the world, the place of music in the world, all kinds of things. But when I first heard Matthew, I ran out and I was telling my wife this morning, it's hard to pick songs that I want to play because, hey, it's like 500 sitting on my computer right now, and going through them almost made me late for the show today. And I want to give you all a taste, just a taste before we get into the show. I want to give you a taste of the kind of music that Matthew creates. And this is called The New Fact, and it's from a two CD set that he released back in February of this year, and it's called Art of the Improviser, and this cut is The New Fact. So let's take a listen to a couple minutes of that, and then we'll come back and we'll welcome Matthew to the show. So check this out. Welcome back. That's The New Fact from Art of the Improviser by Matthew Shipp. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here.
And I have to tell you, it's this CD is really incredible. I really, really appreciate this. And it's hard because every time I get something from you, whether it's old or new, if it supersedes the one I just got, it's like, this is really great.
Thanks.
Yeah, just remarkable, remarkable work. Now, you know, and preparing for the show and trying to think about what is it that you do, you know, and I wanted to, and how you do it. And, you know, people might say, oh, well, come on, man, don't be an idiot. He's a jazz musician. He's whatever. But there's actually a lot more involved in that than that. And a lot of times you actually, and how you do it, I think, is even a bigger question, which is a lot of times you talk about seeing yourself as a painter or an impressionist. And I remember reading sometime somewhere, and I think it was in the book that you did with Steve Delachinsky, Logos and Language.
Right.
Yeah. Where you talked about that and I think it was in the intro to that, where someone was saying that you were looking at drawings for CD covers for your CD covers, and you were trying to pick things that were being shown to you of this artist's work. And you said that you were really excited because you said that those drawings were exactly what was going on in your brain when you play the piano. What are you talking about there? You really view yourself as a painter, an impressionist in relation to this?
Well, no, I don't really view myself as anything. I mean, there's a million things going on. But that I think that particular portion of the book was referring to a certain CD where Steve Delachinsky's wife, actually, who's a painter and a poet, actually did the artwork for it. And just a visceral feeling when I saw some of the images that she did, you know, of certain brainwaves and activities in my own head that go into playing the piano. Now, I don't remember exactly what I said at that point. I think we were talking very specifically about abstract expressionism, and I was commenting that, actually, maybe I wasn't commenting about this, but I do see that within whatever goes on in my head and how that translates into playing an instrument, that there are various streams that kind of inform the movement of the language. And as far as abstract expressionism goes, there's chromatic color fields, a la kind of like what Mark Rothko does, and then there's also kind of a linear thrust that punches a hole in a canvas, sort of like Jackson Pollock does. So I think I was just kind of throwing around some ideas like that at that point in the book. There is a painterly aspect to what I do, but that's one of, you know, millions of things that go into generating space and time.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I had a friend who was a West Coast piano player, and he was, I think you actually may have known of him, as Horace Tapscott.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and I remember...
The great Horace Tapscott.
Yes, yes, exactly. And I remember one time sitting in Leimert Park with him, and we were just talking about his music and where it comes from and what he's doing and what he was working on a symphony for the ghetto, and which is something that I don't think ever really got played in full. He died before he could ever get a chance to even, you know, to play more than 45 minutes of it somewhere. But he was talking about how a lot of the times he was even thinking about this thing of painting pictures with music. But he was also talking about a thing of where he said that he looks in the street, he looks at life, and there's something that happens in the translation between life and what gets generated in his mind as notes and composition and all this. And he begins to hear things in his head that actually concentrate or take to a different level what he sees going on in the street. And he would like point out examples and then say, look, here, this is what I'm hearing. And when he sees this, he says, this is what I'm hearing. There's some kids walking down the street. One jumps up on a car and he just does this little riff, you know, vocally with what he was thinking off of it. Do you ever have that kind of thing going on?
Not exactly, because what I do, I would say that, you know, reality as it translates in regular space and time that we see on the planet Earth doesn't really inform my music in a certain way. I mean, Sun Ra, which is very interesting, you mentioned Horace Tapscott, Scott, because I often think of Horace, and I don't mean this literally, but as a West Coast version of Sun Ra, just in the fact that he had a big band that he operated in, it was community-oriented, and that's kind of what Sun Ra did, you know, here on the East Coast. And Horace Tapscott was a pianist who did community organizing and had a big band that did kind of cosmic music of sorts. So, but Sun Ra often talked about painting pictures of infinity, and there's no correlation between, like, any event or thing that happens and then how I translate that into music. It's kind of more of a mystical, metaphysical thing that deals with very vague emotions and feelings that somehow gets translated into sound. But, you know, whatever the process he was that was describing, I'm sure is kind of mysterious to him. I mean, you know, if he saw those kids and then a riff came out, you know, he doesn't know exactly what's going on in the process to transmit it from here to there. But, you know, that's just very interesting that he chose to share that with you, because that's a very personal thing, how anybody comes up with their music, or, you know, how anything gets put in the hopper of the mind and gets translated to an actual music. I mean, that's a very mysterious thing that usually the creator of it doesn't even know.
Mm-hmm.
I just find it very interesting that he shared that with you.
We're good friends. Right. We're very good friends, actually. All right, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with one of the most amazing pianists, I think, ever, Matthew Shipp. He's one of my favorite musicians, and we're talking about his work and his life, his music, all of that. Now, Matt, one of the things that you express a lot is the role of it's not literally language, but the role of language. And you actually talk about when you play that you actually get out there and you're letting go and you're letting the language flow. And it figures, language always seems to figure conceptually very large in what you're doing with your music, in relation to your music, not necessarily right. What you're doing with it. Can you talk about that a little?
I wouldn't know where to begin.
Just anywhere, man.
There's actually a strain of thought within jazz, not criticism, but jazz talk about, is jazz a language? And there's people that say yes, and there's people that say no. Now, the people that say no usually equate a language with a very literal interpretation of what a language is, meaning that there's a phrase in music has some correlation to like a linguistic structure. And that's not what you're saying when you're saying that music's a language. Albeit in African music, there's actually times when literal discursive language is transmitted through a drum or something like that. But to me, music is, I mean, it's axiomatic that music is a language. That's the premise I start with, and it just seems very obvious to me. I don't actually know any other way to even think of it. And exactly what the language is, you know, is a mystery to me, even as somebody who creates it and partakes in it. But I, you know, transmit vibrations when I play. I mean, that's, to me, music at the bottom of it is vibrations. And I kind of look at myself as a conduit that takes in these vibrations and then can kind of translate them on my particular instrument. And, you know, whatever the language is, again, is kind of a mystery to me. I mean, I inhabit it, or it inhabits me, and I, you know, by instinct and feel I know what it is, but I'm not privy to say, you know, that there's any like direct thing I'm saying when I'm playing, except that I know I'm transmitting some realm of some type of emotional language that's bigger than me, you know. So the idea of a language generator, transmitter, is something that, yeah, it does inform what I play, and it's like you said, it comes up over and over somehow whenever I'm usually talking about music.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a listen to another cut off of your album, Art of the Improviser. And this is track 3 on our disc here. It's track 3. It's called Whole Tone, and we'll be right back after that. Welcome back. That's Whole Tone from Art of the Improviser by Matthew Shipp. Now, Matt, one of the reasons I wanted to play that is because, one, I just really like it a lot, but it's also there's a point that I think I've read you speaking about this with other people and various interviews, different articles about you. The heavy use of sort of the bass register on the piano, the low register, and you once said that this is related to a fact that a lot of your music is actually dealing in some way or another with what you called the void or the abyss. Which is, it's a pretty interesting concept here, actually, and I wanted to explore that a little with you.
Right. Okay, can I just first say that that CD is a two-record set. Two mm-hmm. different live concerts, and like that was a solo cut. So for somebody just hearing it, one side solo and one side with mm-hmm. my trio.
Okay.
And that's from the solo concert, obviously. Yes, I tend to think of the bass register as this kind of collective vortex generator and you know, conduit into the void, because the void is, you know, even beyond the bass register. But I think I know where I think you're talking about one aspect of the book, and we're talking about metaphysics in the book, and we start talking about Jacob Boehme, who was a mystic in the Middle Ages, and the Umgrund, which is kind of his word for the void, and it's a kind of a continuum of infinity where the possibility of everything exists. So you have this very pregnant realm of possibility that is infinite, and it potentially contains every formation and configuration that can happen and every mutation from that. And so it's therefore, you know, an infinite generator of information, and things grow out of that. And you could actually look at space there. I mean, there's a physicist, David Bohm, whose whole thing with space and time is explicit order coming out of the implicit order, which is kind of another way of stating that idea. So I instinctively, you know, in developing my own style, the bass register kind of was that realm of pregnant possibilities where things emerge and then reemerge and then can reemerge at a different time in a slightly different configuration. So it's kind of like this deep unconscious realm or subconscious realm of possibilities, and that is definitely something I do explore, you know, in some aspects of my music. Not all the time, because I'm you know, the piano is a vast kaleidoscope of possibilities, and it has from the very high range to the very low range. There's times where I extend and, you know, completely a linear thing that has nothing to do with the bass register that's very close to Bud Powell or something that might be done in bebop. But that one thing you mentioned is definitely one part of the way I think about music.
We're talking with pianist Matthew Shipp about his life, his work, his music, his art, and his views on virtually everything else in the universe. When we talked, when we first met back in April, and we were talking briefly, and you made a point about that you find yourself living in a post-Coltrane psychological space. And
I said that.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you say it like that. I said that because I've been thinking, what the hell was he talking about there? What were you talking about there? Any ideas?
Well, first of all, today's his birthday. Today is John Coltrane's birthday, so I'm not sure exactly how old he would be if he was still living. But a salute to him. I think what I meant by that was that he was just such an overriding figure in the music that there's a lot of things that happen. I mean, it's been almost impossible for anybody to escape his influence, which is, you know, good and bad. I mean, good because he drove the music forward to it. Great place, and bad because you obviously don't want to be under, you know, cowering under the influence of anybody. But did I say that in a positive way or a negative way?
You said it actually in a positive way. And one thing I think you were, at the time you were hooking it up with this thing about language and getting a quest. There was a point you were talking about the void then too. And I think...
I remember what I was saying. Now that you said it, whenever I hear his late music, not the late music, but maybe, you know, some of the periods between when he's a jazz musician in the sense of what people usually think of in a jazz musician and before his really avant-garde period at the end, when I hear like Meditations or A Love Supreme or stuff like that, what I usually hear, and I think I was equating it, if you would take like a biblical myth, for instance, like the Tower of Babel, and in that story, before the tower was built, there was one universal language, you know, spoken on the earth. And then these people tried to build a tower up to heaven. And whatever his name is got mad and confused their tongues. And so after that, there's, you know, different languages being spoken. Yeah, that's what exists in the myth and the story. And I think what I was conveying is that whatever that, quote, universal language would have been before that, I hear him trying to get to that in his music. I mean, it's almost like he's trying to get to that original universal language before the confusion of tongues. And if you take that into the New Testament, and I'm not a Christian, you know, after Pentecost, supposedly Peter comes out of the room and he speaks to people walking by and they all understand him no matter what language they spoke. So there's a mirror effect between the Old and New Testament that, you know, usually every story in the New Testament, there's something in the Old Testament that relates to or fulfills or something like that. There's this circle with that as far as the idea of a universal language. Now, what I was saying was I hear in Coltrane's music that kind of spiritual quest to break through the sound barrier and to kind of get to the original energy of whatever universal language is. Now, Coltrane was not Christian. He was born and raised Christian, but he kind of got into universal consciousness through various vehicles. And, of course, his wife, Alice, was kind of a practicing Hindu. But he was into universal consciousness and trying to use music as a vehicle to explore that. So, I think that's what I was talking about when I said it.
All right, well, yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, it does. Because it's interesting because there's a certain fearlessness that I think is involved when you're talking about, in whatever you, however you conceive of this abyss, this void, this unknown in the future or unknown that's out there. I was just reading a book, an interview with Cornel West, where they talk about, Cornel talked about how he felt that you really have to, if you're really going to make a difference in the world and to humanity, you have to actually, and in a sense, I guess even in a bigger sense to everything, you're going to have to be fearless about going into the void, you know, and as well as know that have a sense of what you're looking for, but being open to finding whatever it is you're going to find. And he was speaking metaphorically, but it's a very deep concept and extremely important in terms of the kind of creativity that's involved in producing, you know, the kind of art that I think is fitting for human liberation, you know?
Right.
Well, go ahead.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. And I don't know any other way to go about things really.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about this, and let me remind listeners first that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm the host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Matthew Shipp about a number of things, his CD, Art of the Improviser. We're also talking about his work, his art, his life, and all of that. Now, Matt, you really grapple with, or people always pose this to you, and I'm not going to be one to break the chain, but this question of the relationship between improvisation and composition. And I found your thinking on that to be really intriguing. I was really, it really made me think hard about what you were saying there. And I think it was very similar to, I interviewed William Parker, who's, your friend and close, colleague, and you guys create a whole universe of music out there yourselves. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But in terms of really linking very closely improvisation and composition, and even the idea that improvisation is composition. Can you talk about the relationship between improvisation and composition?
Well, it's very hard to just start talking about that without...
Improvise!
without specific, keys or questions, because it's such a vast... And there's so much ignorance involved with, people's concepts of what things are, and you can only really talk about things specifically. I mean, it's hard. But I guess in a very generalized fashion, I would say that a great jazz improviser, and let's pick like maybe the greatest of all time, Charlie Parker, somebody who's quintessentially, you think of it as an extremely gifted improviser. They spend a lifetime developing the language that they are fluent in and having the facility to create in live time, because it's a discipline. You're not just like, some magician. You are a magician because there's a magic to even getting up in the morning, but a skilled improviser has a discipline and a craft that they've worked at their whole life, and creating in live time. If you take like say eight measures of a Charlie Parker solo, and then you take eight measures of some composer who sat down and wrote wrote a piece. I mean, there's similar thought, there's similar cohesion, there is similar thought process. Not, I mean, the thought process is different how they came up with their things, but the actual integrity of the cohesion and the thought process is similar. So basically, a skilled improviser has a language that they work at, and they develop the ability to think quickly and to think in live time and to be able to create a structure with integrity that says something in live time. Now, there's many people that compose things and they go and they sit and they write, and they might write a half-hour piece, and you hear it, and it, you know, whatever, it just doesn't move you or whatever. And there's many people, there are some people who can get up in front of an audience, pick up an instrument, and create something within the language that they know that does move people. So, I mean, why focus on whether, like, you know, somebody sits with a piece of paper and writes something, or whether somebody can pick up their instrument and for whatever reason has the ability and the skills and the inclination to be able to create a statement in live time that has meaning, that has integrity, that has vitality. I mean, that's what an improviser does. So you have to judge things by actually what comes at you, the sound of it, not by some abstract idea that, like, you know, this one thing is better because a bunch of white guys in Europe with white wigs used to do it, as opposed to, you know, somebody being able to pick up a saxophone and, you know, play a blues and really make something happen that they didn't have on paper.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking today with Matthew Shipp, avant-garde pianist and extraordinary musician, artist, and human being. Mm-hmm. You know, I really like this thing that you were talking about, this concept, though, of you know, a musician works and creates this language or this thing that he can draw on, he or she can draw on, all the time. And it reminded me of, and I know this is something that you've wrestled with a little in terms of what you've read about Bob Avakian and the work that he's done in the realm of philosophy, epistemology, you know, a lot of the stuff. And this concept he developed of a solid core with a lot of elasticity. And as I was reading what you were talking about and listening to you now, even in relation to improvisation and composition, I kept thinking about the relationship between those two being actually in some ways an expression of that kind of solid core with a lot of elasticity, where you have that core that both gives you the ability to fly out there and just fly loose, and then you're also, you can come back real quick, right, and on right. the basis of that. So what do you think of that?
Yeah. I mean, I obviously I know the Avakian concept you're talking about and how that he relates that to his ideas and being able to transform society, and by having a solid basis for the ideas that will be the transformative ideas, but yet not being dogmatic and having, you know, allowing a lot of input to come. I mean, I know that it does actually relate. It's funny. I mean, I never actually thought about that, but there is a kind of a similar resonance to those ideas, even though they're in slightly different, you know, realms of thought. But it definitely, I see that.
Well, you know, I want people to get a chance to listen to this next cut, and it's from DNA, which is an album you did with William Parker, who we were just talking about. And I wanted to have people listen to this so that we can then come back and discuss a particular point around it that really kind of had me scratching my head and making me think really, really hard on this. So let's listen to When Johnny Comes Marching Home, or at least a little bit of it, and then we'll come back and talk to you in a minute. Thank you. right, welcome back. That's When Johnny Comes Marching Home, and it's from the CD DNA, and that's Matt Shipp's CD that he did with William Parker, bassist William Parker. And listeners may remember we had William back on the show back in last spring, actually, and it was a remarkable, remarkable conversation. And we're continuing this in a different way now. We're talking with Matthew Shipp, avant-garde jazz pianist, about his life and his work. Matt, your work with William is astounding.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, and I know you've said that yourself.
Well,
and I have to agree. You said that the sound world created between the intersection of his bass and your piano is completely unprecedented in music history. It's a completely original sound world, and I couldn't agree more.
Yeah,
it's like...
I'm sure I did say that.
Okay, well, that's good. And it's interesting because here you have the, you know, look, when I listen to that piece and I listen to your piano and the two of you coming together, one thing that popped into my head is I had a similar conversation with William about improvisation and composition. And he made that point about improvisation is composition. And I was thinking, what's it like? I mean, you've played with him a lot. You know, what's it like for the two of you who both have like these massive ability with the particular form of, you know, the particular form of music that you play in, the instruments you use, that you play on, and you both have a tremendous amount of, obviously, you know, just for lack of a better word, technical skill and knowledge, and you know, you can just run wild with that, and create with that, and improvisation. You're both into improvisation. How does it work when you get two giants like yourselves playing so closely together and creating something that's, I'm sure that has the fact that link between all that you bring to the table, including your penchant for improvisation. How does that work, man? How do you end up doing that without like spinning out into the universe somewhere?
Well, there's a discipline involved. I mean, I think first of all, there's respect between the two the people playing together, respect for each other, respect for the idiom, respect for the language, and respect for the audience even. So there's a discipline that, and I think discipline is the key word, that overtakes the whole process. And that's as much a part of it as the letting go and finding some dialectic between the letting go and the discipline. That's the whole thing right there, the whole secret for me, at least. I can't speak for William, but I can speak for myself. And, you know, I really, the major object when you play is to play music. And that instantly requires, you know, some level of discipline and restraint and respect for the material. So I think that's the overriding thing that kind of allows the whole process to create something that resonates with yourself and hopefully with an audience.
Right. Again, it gets back to that dialectic, that concept I was raising before of solid coin elasticity applying here too in a certain way. That, you know, but what I was also thinking is that it's really interesting that you also have to have some kind of – I mean, you really have to be zoned in with each other. There's the respect and the discipline, but there's – you really have to, in a sense, be zoned into each other to be able to actually carry out this – the compositional part of it, and then to each perhaps go off, you know, even with recognizing that there's the respect and discipline to not, you know, just totally dissipate the whole thing, but to create something that brings the two of you together, the link that you must have between the two of you musically, and even just that vibe that you got going that must lock in pretty hard in terms of being able to create this sound that is very, very different than anything people have ever heard, I think.
Right. Well, yeah, I think with William and I, communication is, I guess, a word that comes to mind. That and it gets back to language, you know, even though we're not talking about, like, saying a sentence like, yeah, I'm hungry, let's go to the store and get some food. I mean, you know, we are talking, and especially a duo is, I mean, all music, but a duo and especially is about communication. In fact, in within music, a duo is as naked, you know, form of communication as you can possibly have between two people, especially without a drum holding it together. I mean, you know, you really have two instruments relating to each other in a dialogue. So it is a language, and within language, the important aspect is communication. That's what you have happening. And I guess I've done a lot of duets with different people, so I can say that a process of a duet, the possibility of an intense, deep communication is either there or it's not. And with Wham and I, for whatever reasons, you know, it's there. And we've been able to exploit that for a long time because we were playing. I mean, William is so busy with his own projects now that I don't really play with him that much. But for years and years, we were a team. You know, we played together in many formats, duos, trios. The David S. Ware Quartet was a band that we were both in, and we both played with Roscoe Mitchell and the Note Factory. And, you know, it's always an honor and a great joy to play with him because he's so strong at being himself and what he does, and he's so giving also at bringing his own thing into somebody else's vision and allowing that to grow and, you know, and thrive.
We're talking with Matt Shipp, jazz pianist, about his life, his work, and the ideas behind it all. Now, let's move into this, because this is something that I thought was really important, too, which is, you know, that you have a very worked out thinking, I think, on in relation to the idea of rejecting the need for musicians and others and of artists and people of all types to reject deification. And also, and I think it's extremely important, you know, of, you know, the people that have gone before, you know, the people
right.
who get enshrined as this is the pillar that you follow. You can't go beyond that, you know.
I think some of that might be media oriented because I do actually deify my idols, you know. I mean, you know, on a certain level, I say stuff in the media, but, you know, if you ask me about my favorite musicians, you get me. One-on-one. I don't drink anymore, but when I used to drink, if I had a few beers in me, you know, I would go off and praise of my favorite musicians. But I do feel that, like, you have to key into yourself and over-deification of the canon can be problematic in that case.
Well, it seems to, you know, there seems to be a point where actually, you know, with deification and reification, actually, even in terms of the art form, it's sort of, you know, where you can actually, by really holding on to those two things, you can actually really contribute to killing the particular art. And it seems to me that it really limits what you have available to you, what you have open to you. And part of that, you described yourself once as being part of the avant-garde, and you said that can encompass everything. And it's taken you a lot of places, including this thing that I have to admit, I stepped back when I read this. It said that you think of yourself as an artist more along the lines of David Bowie than Sonny Rollins. And I was like, what? What's he saying here?
Well, I think did I say that about more than Sonny Rollins? I mean, I remember, I mean, David Bowie is somebody who I've paid attention to, especially growing up. I mean, mainly I liked his music, so. But, you know, he's also a very bright guy and, you know, is in touch with a lot of stuff. But I don't remember exactly what I meant by saying that. I think all music encompasses everything. I mean, I think any musician that is very serious about what they do listens to everything and learns from everything. So I know that's not.
Well, that's what I think you were actually getting at, and I think
that's not a product of like being the quote jazz avant-garde. I mean, I think, you know, everybody even Elton John supposedly has a bunch of Cecil Taylor albums, you know. So you know, music, this is a whole big wide world of music out here, and all of it, every genre has something to teach us also. You know, I'm a student of the big wide world of music and willing to learn from everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me give people a sample of where this has taken you. And Teddy, let's play track 5. We'll be right back. Welcome back. And that's something I will get the name wrong, so you can jump in and yell, Matt, when you hear this. It's IBID Desmarches, IBID. I have no idea what
is that. Is that from the DJ Spooky album?
I was just going to say, yes, it's from the DJ Spooky album. And I think, actually, I wanted to talk to you about that because you've worked with him. You've worked with, you know, Henry Rollins.
Henry produced a bunch of albums.
He produced the albums on his label. You opened up for Sonic Youth.
Right.
You know, which is, and I think it's, and you did, you worked with Anti-Pop Consortium.
Right.
And I'm sure there's probably a lot of things I don't know about. As much research as I did, there's probably a lot I don't know about.
And LP.
LP, that's it. Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with jazz pianist Matthew Shipp. So this is something that I don't think is all that, I mean, maybe it's more, you see it more, you know, in New York, or maybe it's I don't know, but it seems like this is something that's really breaking a lot of boundaries, and it reminded me of this thing that Max Roach once argued against some people who were advocating were more conservative forces in the jazz world. And he spoke about...
I wonder who those people
are. I won't say anything. He was defending hip-hop, and he was defending free jazz, and he said that, look, there's a infinite palette of organized sound in the universe, and no one has the authority to determine what is and isn't part of it. You know, and to me, that seems to have a lot to do with the expansive reach you have and the curiosity and the way you actually do want to take part in a dance of rhythm, and that brings you to a lot of different places. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, I was not unlike Sun Ra, who, you know, the scope of his music throughout the years is very vast. I mean, you take an album like Liquidity or, you know, to from big band to kind of space funk to doing Disney songs to the pure avant-garde. I mean, to like Fletcher Henderson's type of stuff. So why, I mean, you know, I definitely am very focused within the language, but that language can have many manifestations. And there's, like we were talking about the void earlier, within the void, you know, things can emerge, reemerge, transfigure in many different forms. So why limit yourself to one particular way of doing things when there's an infinity of responses to the language out here? So, and what Max Roach said, you know, is 100% true, especially considering that he was saying that to people that, you know, have kind of a fascist attitude about what constitutes, you know, trying to protect their little precious jazz, you know. So, I mean, I really enjoy and learn from working with people like Spooky and Anti-Pop Consortium and LP and the various electronic people or hip-hop artists that I have worked with. I mean, you know, that's not the main strand of what I do, but it's been a really cool way to generate variety and to explore other avenues that are a little different than what I usually do in my own music. And I've done 3 albums on my own that deal with kind of electronica type of influences, Equilibrium, New Bop, and Harmony and Abyss, and, you know, which are different than the stuff, the collaborations I actually do, because in those albums, I'm actually trying to take the electronic landscapes and kind of make the same type of space-time that I have in my own other jazz albums. So, so they're more of a marriage of the electronica with me than me with the electronica, which is when I collaborate. You know, there's a slightly different world than my own albums where I've used electronica, but it's a very fertile ground. I'm not really doing that much of it right now because I'm more centered in my own acoustic jazz thing, but there is a new album out with Anti-Pop called Noise from Heaven, and I had an album last year with Scanner, an English electronica artist, and it's a part of the language. What can you say?
And Knives from Heaven, I really like as well. It's just, you know, the other one that you did with them, I really like. I mean, it's interesting to me because you pull all this together, and there's that fearlessness rooted in an understanding of sort of, again, that giant infinite palette of organized sound and what difference it makes. And I thought there's, and this will lead into what will probably be the last question, but it's the idea that you have. I don't know, you talked about once about punk and, And because I was also, I do have to admit again, I was kind of taken back about opening for Sonic Youth. And not so much about Henry Rollins actually producing, and you were on the label that he had, one of the labels that he had. And you know, because Henry has such a gigantic embrace of musical forms himself, and he's really an incredible cat. But more the thing of actually this idea that, you know, that punk had something in common with jazz in its early days and free jazz now, in terms of the question of screw you, screw America, you know? I mean, right. That's a very good, and I think it comes out in your music. I think it comes out in a lot of things. And I was thinking about this particular, because I was preparing for the show, you know, they murdered Troy Davis.
Right. And I'm still not over that. I was got a very sickening feeling watching the news the other night, and watched it out of actually disbelief that, you know, everybody knows what's happening, but the system can't stop something that's obviously messed up. I mean, it was just disquieting, and just I couldn't, you know, you just watching it unfold, you can't believe it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you find out in those 3 or 4 hours they had him waiting there, they had him strapped to the gurney that entire time.
Right.
You know, I mean, and it says something about the nature of this society, especially in relation to black people and the genocidal implications of so much that they do in relation that this system does in relation to black people. This is incredible. You know, everyone knew, you know, the question of innocent until proven guilty has disappeared. Everyone knew that this cat, I mean, there was no argument. It wasn't, and I get really angry at these people who are saying, well, we can't say he was innocent, but we can't say there was enough doubt. You know what? When there's no physical evidence and 7 out of 9 eyewitnesses say,
right. And that's what he was convicted on. I mean, come on. I mean, that was a couple nights ago. I really, a friend of mine called me, Sabir Mateen, great tenor sax player. And we were just like sick. I mean, you know, physically ill, actually, watching a murder basically occur on TV. I don't have anything to say about that. It's self-evident.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, because when we first met, it was at the April 11th event at the Harlem Stage in New York. And it was on the occasion of the publication of Basics, which is a new book by Bob Avakian. It was a celebration of revolution and the vision of a new world. What about, just stepping back in the context of what we were talking about, what is your take on America and the need to get to a new world?
My take on America?
Yeah.
well, I mean, to be honest, there's things about America that I like, but I mean, I don't see how you can have anything happen in a situation where 1% of the people own 90% of the wealth. I mean, that's just axiomatic that, like, everything is off base and messed up and out of focus. So, while there's things about America that abstractly and potentially are great, I just don't see how we can move on in any really, in any really profound way unless people kind of get a little more mature. I think the whole healthcare thing that happened a couple years ago really put a bad taste in my mouth about this country. I was in Europe recently, in Italy. You know, I was performing there. I forgot. Ancona was the city. And I was talking to a promoter, and he was telling me about a jazz musician who came to Italy for surgery in the 70s on Malachi Favors, the great bassist. Basis from the Art Ensemble of Chicago, and he just made this comedy. Yeah, you know, he had some friends here, and we were able to hook him up, and, you know, surgery was free. You know, he goes, yeah, you know, I don't understand your country. People in your country are stupid. You know, you want to pay a lot for healthcare. It was just so kind of bizarre that, you know, he just said that.
You're listening to the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with jazz pianist Matthew Shipp. Well, you know, one of the things that really gets me is actually, one thing that has me very worried is the increasing renewed interest in the movie Soylent Green, okay, especially as I age.
Right.
They'll be eating us soon. Here's the thing, though. You participated in this event that was about a celebration of revolution and the vision of a new world. And I remember talking to you about, and in particular, it was also hooked into, people came into it for many reasons, and it was also hooked into Avakian and his work. And I wanted to ask you, you know, this point about the vision of a new world. What's your thinking about that? And even, you know, what you said to me at that time, that you thought that there was one of the things that really attracted you to Avakian, was that you said he talks about the need for a poetic spirit if you're going to be making a revolution. And I wanted to, you know, get your thoughts on that, if you had any more thoughts on that.
Well, I think that, you know, people have to unleash their imagination. And I think that's what all art is about, on one level, you know, the unleashing of the imagination on people. And I think that our most precious resource are people. So if you have people really having freedom and the ability to open up and to trust, you know, the faith in their own subconscious processes and what goes on, and I think that's when solutions surface. And the thing I think I told you, I remember saying that I liked about Avakian, because I'm not exactly coming from where he comes. I mean, he's, you know, I'm not a member of the Communist Party, or I'm not a member of anything. I'm just like the guy, a weird guy that plays piano weird, you know. But there's an openness in his work and a kind of a non-dogmatic strain that recognizes that whatever revolution would be, and nobody knows, you know, I mean, he's a theorist. He doesn't know what it would look like exactly. Nobody does. But that, you know, there has to be a poetic spirit to it. It's not about just having like a vanguard party in the state dictate things. It's not about a lot of things people think it's about. It's about unleashing the awesome, infinite creativity of ideas that people have that leads to some type of profound and thing that makes sense for everybody. So, you know.
Well, one thing. Go ahead.
No. I mean, that's
all right. Well, one thing that you also said that I thought was very profound and it stuck with me for a long time is you said actually the firmness with which Avakian operates in his approach, and as well as with the elasticity he has, gives you the sense that you could actually work and work within that approach, work within that kind of society that would be set up. That it gave you the freedom. His firmness in that gave and in his approach gave you the freedom to carry out your approach. And I thought that was really profound.
Yeah. That's what I mean when I've read about, you know, I've always been struck by the fact that, like, for instance, you know, you mentioned Cornel West. Now, I mean, you know, Cornel West is a big fan of Avakian's work, and Avakian is, you know, I mean, Cornel West is a born again Christian, so there couldn't be, like, you know, two more, not extremes, but I mean that, you know, but I feel within Avakian that what he talks about and how he sees society, and utopian is not the word, because it's not about utopia. It's about, because that's not possible, you know, it's about having something that makes sense for everybody, and where everybody can really have the means to kind of control, you know, what needs to be controlled in their life. And I have, when I read Avakian, even though I'm not, quote, a communist, you know, I always can feel that, like, yeah, I can operate within this paradigm. I mean, the paradigm's open enough, it's flexible enough that it encompasses, you know, a lot of things that could exist within it.
And the unleashing of human imagination, right? And
right.
And on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up. But Matt, I really, really enjoyed talking with you today.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, sure. Really. I want to get out to L.A. soon.
And when you do, we'll have you in for another hour, and we'll just sit across and we'll talk. The hell with everybody
say
else listening.
Hi to Mark and to Omar for me.
Definitely, man. Talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
All right, before we close out the show, I'm going to read you this quote from Bob Avakian, and it's taken from his new book, Basics, from the Talks and Writings of Bob Avakian. And I'm reading it to you because it has a lot to do with what we've just been talking about. Would the best of Bob Dylan have been brought forward if we had led that step by step, especially if we had done this in a narrow, reformist, and kind of workerist way, and an instrumentalist way? Insisting that every artistic creation have some direct and linear relation to politics, and in particular the immediate political struggles of the day. No! So then, does that mean we don't need model works that are really models? No, we do need those things, and there are artists who will be willing to work with us in that way, especially if we work correctly with them. But that's not all we need. Life is much more rich. That's the point Lenin was making when he emphasized that the tree of life is much more green than that. Communism does spring from every pore, as Lenin also emphasized, but this won't happen if we stop up every pore with a pitiful dogmatist caricature of communism and communist leadership and methods. Even what's not communism can contribute to communism if we know how to lead correctly, if we know how to correctly apply solid core with a lot of elasticity. All right. Once again, that was from Bob Avakian's new book, Basics, from the Talks and Writings of Bob Avakian, which you can get at www.revcom.us/basics. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my line producer, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Gamma Ray from Matthew Shipp's latest album, The Art of the Improviser. Check it out.